Hi, welcome to Indiana Weekend with John Strauss. This is a kind of radio magazine show about the interesting places and intriguing people in our part of the state. We get out of the studio and onto the road to find the kind of radio you don't hear so much anymore. Stories off the beaten path and usually away from the top headlines. We figure the weekend is a good time for that. Time to lean back a little, slow down, meet somebody interesting, hear what people are saying. Of course, when we're not on the radio, you can catch up with us on Facebook. Just search Indiana Weekend. And we'd love to hear your thoughts about the show, your comments, thoughts about whom we might talk with, or where you would like to hear our microphones. Our email address is, conveniently enough, indianaweekend@gmail.com. I'm John Strauss. In our hyperspeed, internet-paced digital age, we tend to think of even the 1990s as kind of a long time ago. It's easy to lose track of our history, of the time when Indiana was part of the Northwest Territory, stretching from the Ohio River to the Great Lakes, over to the Mississippi, a time when traveling all day could mean a journey of a whole 20 miles. And of the time, this month, 221 years ago, of a battle now often forgotten, a battle that remains the greatest defeat of the United States Army by Native Americans. The Battle of the Wabash featured two remarkable personalities, General Arthur St. Clair, who was also governor of what is now Indiana and the rest of the Northwest Territory, and a great Indian leader named Little Turtle. Back then, Cincinnati was known as Fort Washington, and before there was a Fort Wayne, that spot was Kikionga, capital of the Miami Indian tribe. St. Clair's army was marching from present-day Cincinnati to present-day Fort Wayne, building a fort every 20 miles. Their date with destiny, just northeast of Muncie, would occur on November 4, 1791. Chris Keller is a Ball State archaeologist. She says, imagine the long marches, the chill of approaching winter.
They came upon the banks of the Wabash, and they mistakenly thought it was the banks of the St. Mary's. So they thought they were much closer to Kikionga than they actually were. And for unknown reasons, they made no fortifications that night. It was late. The men were tired. They didn't have good supplies. They were hungry. It was cold. It was snowing. And they actually just camped for the night. And they sent out search parties, and there was some Indian activity in the area, but they had no idea what was to come.
And what was to come? You had like a confederacy of Indian forces,
right,
that had that were mounting this opposition.
Right, right. So the Native American scouting parties had been basically following St. Clair's march up to Kikionga, and they had assembled a confederacy of nine Indian tribes. Probably the two most influential were the Miami and the Shawnee, and a total of probably 1,500 warriors of these nine different tribes. And there's accounts that we know exactly how many of the different tribes are involved. And they had come down from Fort Wayne in like little hunting parties, so in little groups of 30. And so there's really no warning that this confederacy was assembling. And they assembled northwest of present-day Fort Recovery, and they basically assembled on a high ridge so they could see St. Clair's camp, but the topography was such that St. Clair couldn't see them. And so part of our research, which was very interesting, was doing GIS data models to see how in the world could 1,500 Native Americans assemble without St. Clair knowing. And part of it was the clever use of the landscape. So when we talk about Little Turtle and Blue Jacket being great battle tacticians and using strategy well, that's part of it. They knew how to use the landscape because they were familiar with it from hunting and such.
Did you locate that bluff that the Native American forces were watching from? Where is that?
That would be northwest of town, and you can still see it. So the landscape's still there.
Is this very close to the Indiana-Ohio border?
It is. So we're probably less than a mile from the Indiana-Ohio border. So that night, this confederacy, they called it Cold Camp. They actually stayed in a camp north of that ridge and didn't make any fires. And so there was no evidence that, you know, 1,500 men would make a lot of fires. So there was no evidence that were there. The news of the scouting parties from St. Clair's army that there were Indians in the area basically never made it back to St. Clair. He went to bed early because he had gout, and the major in charge didn't pass the word on to him because I think there was some personality conflicts there. So I think.
What was St. Clair like? Was he a difficult person?
you know, I think compared to, we always compare him to General Anthony Wayne. I think compared to Wayne, he wasn't as much of a disciplinarian. He had troops that weren't well trained. He kind of had all the odds stacked against him. So I think he certainly didn't have luck on his side, and he didn't have the government on his side as far as supplies and funding. So
he complained about a lack of supplies, isn't that right?
Yes. Supplies were lacking. They were inferior quality. They talked about how they would, you know, open up gunpowder and it would be wet or it wouldn't work correctly or something like that. And he also had Kentucky militia, and he had what they called 30-day specials, where men from out east could either decide to stay in jail. So they were basically
inmates.
So they either could decide to serve their term in jail, or they could come out and fight the Native Americans.
So desertion was probably a problem.
Yes, it was a problem.
What about the other side? Little Turtle, one of the most famous American Indian figures.
Yes, and like I said, he I don't want to call him the mastermind behind this, but obviously he was respected, and obviously there was a camaraderie there, and they were protecting their homeland, and they were protecting their culture, and there was a reason these nine tribes came together, because they felt like that was important enough to protect.
I was going to say, if you could set the scene a little bit, it's 1791. The United States is a very, very young nation. This area, I mean, Indiana wouldn't become a state for nearly 20 more years.
Right.
And so what was it like? I mean, present-day Cincinnati was Fort Washington. Present-day Fort Wayne was the headquarters of the Miami Nation, right?
Right. And there wasn't really much in between. And there wasn't, you know, I mean, it was the home of the Native Americans, and it was home of these different tribes. And, you know, it was their hunting ground. And there might not have been, there were permanent villages. I mean, you know, we can see maps of, you know, Kikianga and Auglaize in Ohio, and the different, especially in Ohio, the different towns. So, you know, they had villages, but they also used it as a communal hunting ground. And so they knew the landscape well, and they knew the territory well.
All forested? Was this just vast tracts of woods?
Yeah, forested, which is one of the problems when St. Clair came up. You know, they had to basically make their path through the woods. It was also very swampy, you know, just south of Fort Recovery. So they talked about how they had to make, like, log roads or log traces. So it wasn't an easy trek through the woods.
And they're bringing cannon.
Yeah. They're bringing cannons. And so I think, if I remember correctly, you know, they would lay these, like, log roads to get the cannons across, and I can't imagine. I've felt some of these artifacts, the guns they carried, and the muskets, and you know, just the equipment the men carried. I mean, that's a lot of equipment and heavy, and I can't imagine trudging through the marshy forest like that.
Ball State archaeologist Chris Keller, who's done research at Fort Recovery, Ohio, just across the Indiana line. That is the site of the Battle of the Wabash, this month, November, 221 years ago. Worse than the better-known Custer's Last Stand, this was the greatest defeat of the United States Army by American Indians in history. It happened just northeast of Muncie. Of the 1,000 soldiers led that day by General Arthur St. Clair, fewer than 50 escaped unharmed. In part two, we'll pick up the story of that fateful morning.
Indiana Weekend, real radio from just down the road. Look for that name on Facebook and drop us a line to let us know what you think at indianaweekend@gmail.com. Now here's John Strauss.
We see them all the time. American flags waving proudly over, well, not just courthouses and schools, but stores, office buildings, and of course, car lots. They're so common, you don't even notice them anymore. That is until you drive past Sam Pierce's flag. His massive banner is good for sales at his Chevrolet dealership in Daleville. But talk to Sam Pierce and you understand it's about more than just business.
This flag is 30 by 60, which is 1,800 square feet, about the size of my home, square footage wise. So it was the largest flag that we could find for a landmark that we decided that we wanted to project here at the new dealership in 2003.
I was going to say, if you want a flag bigger than that, you practically have to have a marching band or something to carry it, right? I mean, it would be something from the Rose Bowl parade or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, we have on several occasions loaned the flag to Ball State. for their football games and other programs, and it takes several people to hold the flag and keep it off the ground, obviously.
About how much does it weigh when you pull that thing down?
That I don't know. It's quite an effort to get the flag up and down. It takes, if it's a little bit windy, we've got a 10 or 12 mile an hour wind, it'll take six guys to, and it'll pick a guy up, you know, if there's enough wind behind it to put some pressure down. We usually it takes at least, on a normal day, it'll take a guy on the chain, and then a guy to catch it. And as we take the flag down, we guide it into a container on wheels, and it'll take maybe three or four guys at a minimum to get the flag down and get it put away.
Now, you can't buy something like that at Walmart or something.
No.
Is there a catalog that you know?
We buy the flags from a company in Illinois, and the wind is very has a very traumatic effect on the flags, as well as the rain and the sun. So two or three times a year, we'll wear out a flag, and we keep in stock to replace the flag, obviously.
Were you ever in the service?
Well, I'm a Vietnam veteran, a combat veteran from the late 60s.
Who were you with?
I was with the AmeriCal Division in Chu Lai, Vietnam, in the Central Highlands.
Enlisted guy, officer?
Drafted, actually. I was eventually made it to sergeant. I was in the infantry and served in Vietnam for a year. Obviously, the flag means a lot to a lot of Americans, and I couldn't have thought of or come up with a better landmark being where we're located here in the middle of kind of between two cities, Muncie and Anderson. We couldn't find a better landmark, and it's actually done wonders for us in that manner. We've had people stop in from Ohio for that reason, and the end result was we sold them a new truck or a new car. In this case, specifically, the guy from Ohio, the last one I recall, bought a new truck, and on the way to the Indy 500, he and his wife were traveling down 67 and passed the flag, and they both looked at each other, and he said to her, and these are his exact words, "We've got to stop there." So on the way home, they stopped, and end result is we sold him a new truck. Couldn't imagine that happening, but that's the result of something like that we just come up with as a landmark. So.
You started in 1983. Was there a business that you were in, or was there something that you did before you got into the car business?
Well, actually, I worked at the General Motors Transmission Plant in Muncie after high school, and was drafted and went to the service. And during that time, I've always fooled with cars and mechanic, you know, shade tree type mechanic, worked on cars and raced cars. And that led me to leaving the plant to start a used car business. So I did that, and then in 1980, the economy was really probably tougher than it is today, I guess. Interest rates were 20%, and it was really tough. A lot of local businesses went out of business, and I just happened to be in a position in 1982. I discovered one that had went out of business in Middletown, that being the Chevrolet dealership there, and pursued that through General Motors and GMAC, and they helped us get started over there. So that's where we started.
Daleville Chevy dealer Sam Pierce on the giant American flag that takes six people to raise or bring down. It's so big, 60 feet by 30 feet. The weather is hard on flags, so he has to replace them two or three times a year. That costs about $1,500 a flag. Just one of those landmarks you drive by and wonder about.
This is Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.
It was this month, 221 years ago, a cold November morning. There was snow. About 1,000 United States soldiers were on a mission from present-day Cincinnati to present-day Fort Wayne. Only it wasn't called Fort Wayne then. It was the capital of the Miami Nation, Kikionga. The Americans were building a series of forts to solidify their hold on the region. a confederation of tribes including the Miami, the Shawnee, and the Delaware, led by Little Turtle of the Miami and Blue Jacket of the Shawnee, weren't going to let that happen. Their scouts watched as the soldiers set up camp on the Wabash River northeast of Muncie. The soldiers were tired, cold, with poor supplies. They set up camp for the night without building a defensive wall. The Indians watched from a nearby bluff. They made a cold camp, not lighting any fires, and so the Army's own scouts didn't know that a major force of 1,000 warriors was nearby. What happened next would change history. It's why there's a city called Fort Wayne, and it began, as Ball State archaeologist Chris Keller told us, early that morning on November 4th.
Then at dawn the next morning, I would guess 6:30-ish, the Native American forces, basically within less than an hour, completely surrounded St. Clair's encampment. It's a large area, and they were in a big crescent formation. And so the middle of the crescent rushed the Kentucky militia, and the Kentucky militia were completely surprised, and they basically turned around and rushed back into the main camp across the river and created total chaos. So you had, you know, your own men coming into camp, and the main camp really had no idea what was going on. All they could hear was the din and the noise and the yells of the Native Americans. And you read firsthand accounts, and I've read them a lot, and it still gives you chills to hear the noise that they heard, and if you can imagine 1,500, you know, men, warriors of, you know, the screams and the yells and the.
There was almost a kind of psychological warfare.
Absolutely. And the more we research it, and the more we see, especially the use of this crescent and the use of this tactic of surrounding the enemy and then rushing them, yeah, it was psychological because it was just terror. And they talked about how, you know, men would just, you know, throw down their arms because they didn't even know what to do. And another tactic they used is, you know, they tried to pick off and shoot the soldiers that were manning the cannons. So the whole idea is if they could get rid of those cannons, then they could, you know, come forward even more.
Of course, if the assault means overrunning the defenders, the cannon don't have a lot to shoot into, right?
Right.
The Native Americans used sharpshooters or marksmen to take the artillery out of the fight.
Right.
So the Indians had firearms as well.
Yes, they did. And so that was one of the things that they tried to do is get the cannons. And one of the cannons that still worked were actually shooting the shot. They were on a hill, and so they were shooting the shot like up above the Native Americans' heads. And so, you know, that whole thing was kind of a miscalculation because they couldn't really shoot the cannons where they needed to. So they talked about how they would hit the trees and the limbs would fall. And
this would have been a very terrifying moment if you were one of these Americans.
Yes.
And you had to feel that you were completely surrounded anyway, right?
Right?
You're in hostile territory to begin with. And then to hear the screams of the assault.
Right. And they also had they had 250 camp followers, which were basically women and children. And they talked about how they were all huddled in the middle of the main camp. And they were also talked about in the firsthand accounts how some of the soldiers were huddled under, you know, either wagons or, you know, in tents to try to protect themselves. And, you know, I can just imagine the chaos of the camp because here they are surrounded and the officers are trying to get the men in some kind of formation. And it's just a mess. And you have the Kentucky militia coming in. So the strategy used by the Native Americans was basically to fold the soldiers onto themselves and cause, you know, basically wreak havoc by this commotion and this.
So the defenders aren't able to mount much of a counterattack, and a lot of them fled, or?
There was a lot of casualties, 900 killed or wounded, mortally wounded. And the way the battle unfolded is that the direction the wind was blowing, the south end of camp was basically, you couldn't see, and there was smoke. The north end of camp was a little clearer because of the wind direction, and so they could at least get the enlisted men in formation on the north end of camp, and they mounted like a flanking maneuver to kind of open up a hole in the surrounding Native Americans. And so they opened up a big enough gap that the survivors could retreat. And one of the things that we're learning as we do this research is that was a pretty typical response by the Native Americans as well. They used this crescent because they wanted to minimize casualties as well. So if that meant that they would let part of the army retreat, you know, after the battle was, you know, theirs, then that was okay. They would do that because that would eliminate casualties on their side. So
they'd push them out through that opening in the crescent and headed north, I guess, back across the river.
They actually made a big loop and headed back south down the trace where they came. So they went down the same road that they came, and there's accounts that the survivors, so the battle was over by 9:30. So it started at 6:30. The battle was basically done in 3 hours, and the survivors basically ran back to Fort Jefferson, which was 23-some miles away, you know, south. And they talked about how they fled, that they would just throw their guns with the bayonets on them, and whatever they could, they would just throw it on the ground so they could run fast. And accounts talk about not only were they worried about the Native Americans catching them, they were also worried about stepping on a bayonet or a rifle. And lots of community members in Fort Recovery have found over the years, you know, different artifacts in their yards, which would have been on this area of retreat.
These were muskets, basically. These weren't rifles with cartridges. I mean, if you fired a shot, you had to laboriously charge it.
With the ramrod and, yes, you know, flintlock and Charleville muskets. And they're big, heavy. You know, we got the privilege of picking up some of those artifacts, and they're big, heavy armaments. I can't imagine. I had no idea they would be that heavy.
Be hard to hold up to your shoulder, aim
yes.
for very long.
And certainly, if you're running for your life, you're going to get rid of those.
What do we know about Little Turtle and Blue Jacket?
You know, having grown up at Fort Recovery and having heard the story over and over and over again, I've kind of gained new insight by doing this research. I mean, I look at them as they were protecting their homeland, they were protecting their way of life. You know, they were doing what they needed to do to protect their families and their way of life. And I'm not sure if anybody, I can't begrudge them that. And so, you know, the more I learn about this, the more I respect what they did and how they did it and how the amount of planning and strategy and cohesiveness that Confederacy must have had. So to have 9 different tribes that probably spoke different dialects and have them work as a single unit, it's pretty amazing.
Chris Keller, a Ball State archaeologist who grew up in Fort Recovery, Ohio, hearing stories of the famous Battle of the Wabash there, which happened this month in 1791 and was the biggest loss by U.S. forces against Native Americans. That's our show for today. I'm John Strauss. Big thanks to our producer, Marcus Jackman. Glad you could join us this time and hope you'll stay in touch. Drop me a note at indianaweekend@gmail.com if you would like more information or have a suggestion. Reminder that we also need your stories, your ideas for places we should go and people we should talk to. In the meantime, thanks and have a great week. Until we meet again on the next Indiana Weekend on Indiana Public Radio, I'm John Strauss.
Indiana Weekend with host John Strauss of the Ball State Journalism Department. Our show is engineered at Indiana Public Radio, produced by Marcus Jackman. Major support for Indiana Weekend comes from Dillman's Furniture, Muncie, serving East Central Indiana with home furnishings from Flex Steel, Bassett, and Simmons Beautyrest. Join us again next week for Indiana Weekend with John Strauss here on Indiana Public Radio.